Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players and other musicians, uncover their life stories, and discover what makes them tick. If you love guitar, music, and the backstory of people's lives, then stick around. You're in the right place. If you, like the rest of America, are looking to move down here to the Tampa Bay area in Florida and you want to work with a realtor who knows the area well, then make sure you reach out to Ann at West Florida Real Estate. Ann has sold over 350 homes here in the Bay Area over the last 6 years. She's smart, she's lived in the area for 16 years, and you won't find anyone around with a better work ethic. Reach out to her at Ann with an E at westfloridarealestate.com and let her know you heard about her here on Everyone Loves Guitar. That's Ann with an E at westfloridarealestate.com. For information on advertising, go to everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. And if you're enjoying the show and you'd like to support it, go to everyonelovesguitar.com/support. Hey, everybody, this is Craig Garber from Everyone Loves Guitar, and I'm with a really cool blues artist today and a tremendous guitar player with Anthony Gomes. Anthony was originally from Canada, and he earned the University of Toronto's C.P. Stacey Prize for the highest overall academic GPA by a history student. So we're going to quiz you at the end of this, and we're going to use a bunch of SAT words to make sure you're on board with this. He then completed his master's degree thesis on the racial and cultural evolution of blues music, and he graduated with high distinction from Canada's top university. He then spent brief stint as a sideman for Magic Slim and the Teardrops, put together his own group, and he won the first annual Buddy Guy's Legends Best Unsigned Blues Band competition in 1998. Later that year, he released his debut CD called Blues in Technicolor. His albums have been included in the top 30 essential blues albums of all time list. He's been named Artist of the Year for several years running by Blueswax magazine, and five of his albums have been in the top 10 Billboard Blues Records. He's released 13 solo records, and he's fresh from his victory at the European Blues Awards for the Best Musician in Live Performance. Comes his latest record, which is called Peace, Love, and Loud Guitars, and we'll talk about this record today. He also founded, this is really cool, the Music is the Medicine Foundation in 2010, and we'll talk about that. That's a nonprofit that's dedicated to changing the lives of others through the healing power of music. It's something that we really need today. Through private donations and winning sizable grants from State Farm and CVS Pharmacy, the foundation has funded songwriting scholarships, offered music education programs, and also donated musical instruments to those in need. Anthony, thanks so much for your time, and I really appreciate you coming on the show.
Hey, man, my pleasure. Thanks for having me here.
We talked about this a little before. You were pretty academically inclined as a youngster. You got an undergraduate and a master's degree in college. And I was curious, what drove you to do this back then, and what'd you learn from that experience?
Well, I love school and I love studying and learning, but a big part of it was to bamboozle my parents that I was actually not going to become a professional musician. And it bought me some time. You know, I was like, okay, I'll get another degree and my band can maybe make it in this next, you know, year and a half.
That's so
cool.
That's
what that was really about.
That's great, man. That is hilarious. In retrospect, right? Are you glad you did it? Did good stuff come out of it for you? I mean, or did you, did that extra time you bought help you out?
Oh man, I think it did worlds of good because, you know, like you mentioned, I got my degree in studying the blues, and being a Canadian white boy, I say being white and Canadian is sort of like being white twice.
Yeah, kind of.
yeah, it is. You know? So it's like, how do you find your place in the blues?
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't as popular in Canada. It had small pockets of popularity. I was trying just to find my way. Also, too, I mentor a bunch of younger guitar players, and you know, they hit me up on Facebook, and so, you know, sometimes we'll have little lessons or we'll talk about things on the phone, and I tell them, you know, learn as much as you can. You've got to write lyrics. I mean, you've got to say something. So try to do it in the most clever and intelligent way possible. And going to school is just like practicing your guitar. It's running scales for your brain, and that's very important, and that'll all come back to you. And so far it seems to be working. So, they take that advice. Yeah.
Awesome. It's funny you mentioned Canada. I've had like three people in the last, you know, listeners just like randomly write me in, hey, Craig, you know, Canada, weed is now completely legal in Canada. I love this country. That is like the same message from three random people. I was like, it's quite, I was like, okay.
Well, you know, Canada is known for a lot of things, but I think their stance on marijuana is now trumping all the other wonderful things that the country's known for too.
Absolutely.
But, yeah, it's a very open and accepting society in Canada. There's not a lot of cultural fear. People seem to talk about things. But I think it's just a sign of things to come for the rest of the, you know, modern world.
I hope. Let me ask you a question, and this is not a political question because this is not a political show at all. What do you think accounts for that difference? Where, because it does seem a lot more open up there, and it does seem I was talking with my wife this morning. They said that they are going to release, you know, anybody who is in prison for weed, which makes sense because it's legal now. So what do you know? Why? Again, with not asking you for political, just asking, you've lived here, you grew up there. Right. What do you think is the inherent difference that causes that?
Well, it's cold up there, so you don't have time to mess around, man. I mean, you stay inside, you keep to yourself. You don't cause any problems because you're freezing. That's probably a big part of it. I just think, you know, people are people. Look, I've spent a lot of time in America, and I consider it my second home. And I love American people. And anywhere around the world where we go, the one thing I'm reminded of is people are people. Yeah. It's just you have different social structures set up in different countries. And, it's so great to see that the way that we do it here is not the way that it has to be done. It may be the best way. Or there's other countries may have a better version of education or a better version of what have you, you know, and we can all learn from one another. Without getting political, I just think that one, Canada's a smaller country, so it's easier to do things. I mean, geographically it's big, but there's only, 33 or so million people in Canada. So
you're kidding.
It's easier to. Most of them live on. Yeah, most of them live on the border because it's cold. Like 80% of the population lives like 75 miles by the border. So I think that that's a big part of it too. And, states, and you're a melting pot. You sort of become one of this great big thing. Canada looks at it as a cultural mosaic, which is like your grandma's bad quilt. In that we all have different cultures and you can see them and we can celebrate them, but they form one, but there's no melting. It's just you sew them together. And I grew up in Toronto, very multicultural city. I think in the local parliament, there's 200 different ethnicities represented, out of 300 people or so, I guess, just spitballing numbers. But, I grew up with, when I moved to the States, I realized that it was a very polarized country in some ways, where in Canada, I mean, it's not black and white. It's black, white, brown, light brown. You know, you got Asia, so, all these different cultures. And that was, it was sort of like Star Wars in the cantina bar scene, where you got all everybody from everywhere. And that's really what Canada and Toronto was for me. And I really feel... I feel a lot of gratitude that I had that experience. And I think it's, even when we go on tour, it's interesting to see musicians that I've toured with that haven't had that experience, and they go to other countries and they realize that, man, people are people. Yeah. We all just want the same thing. We want our kids to be okay. We want to pay our bills.
Yeah.
We want to have a little money on the side, and just enough, enough to get by and have some security and take care of the ones we love and not cause any trouble, it's really eye-opening when people get to see that. And sometimes being in a different culture, it allows you the ability to do that easier than when you're at home.
Yeah. Thanks, man. I appreciate you answering that. And I agree with you. I think people are people too, no matter where you're on the world. And I think all those things you said are the basic things we're all trying to do. It's nothing really more complex than that, man.
No. I mean, you know, the one thing I love about music is that it brings us together, you know. Politics divides us.
Oh,
and
God,
I mean, and it divides us on purpose. You know, to me, politicians are like a doctor that makes you sick, so you got to keep on going back.
Yeah, 100%.
You know, there's a lot of people that don't believe what they're saying, but they know it's getting them traction. You know, at least music, you know, the more that we can concentrate on things that bring us together, I think the better we're going to be in 2018 and 2019.
Yeah, man, I agree with you. You've got a great catalog, man. You got 13 records in 20 years, which is awesome, especially with the quality of what you put out. You know, you listen to your music and you know that, okay, this guy came to play, didn't come to play. He was super serious and you're giving 110%, you know?
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. And I go back to my other question about, you know, you went and you got an undergrad and a master's degree. And then you look at this catalog, it seems that you're very driven and you got an excellent work ethic, which to me, the older I get, the more I look to that one particular trait to almost assess someone's total character, because work ethic to me, I think, tells you a lot about somebody. What drives you, man? Like, why are you so driven, basically? And like, what do you get out of that?
Growing up in Toronto in the time I did, we were all children of immigrants. I only knew two kids in my whole high school who had both parents that were born in Canada. So my dad was the only kid in his village in Portugal with shoes. And he grew up in the Depression and he was raised during World War II. And he started to work full time at 13. And he put himself through high school part time. And then eventually college. And then before finishing college, he had an opportunity at 25 to immigrate to Canada. He also had served 2 years in the army. And so he moved to Canada at 25, not knowing a single word of English, except probably the bad words, and $40 in his pocket.
Wow.
I mean, I can't even imagine. And my dad was no different than the kid growing up next door whose dad came from Poland. And the other kid next door whose dad came from Italy. And all we saw our dads bust their, and their moms, both their parents, you know, really just bust their hump, just trying to make a life for us. And they always said, you know, yeah, so my dad basically came to Canada with $40 in his pocket and didn't know a word of English. And he was no different than the dad next door. Or the mom that had come from Poland or the Czech Republic or France or any place, you know. And what it really taught us is that our parents had given their lives for us. They had said, you know what, I'm doing this for my children. And it used to be like that in the States in the 50s too. There were a lot of immigrants and, you know, you think of New York City in the 50s and 40s and, this country was really born on immigrants and, yes, and just, man, we have it so good here and we forget about it. You know, we just did a show in Mexico and I love the Mexican people, you know, they're so passionate, but the poverty there was horrible.
Yeah.
And, you know, we came across the border and it was like, I want to kiss the ground.
Yeah.
And we've forgotten that. And so that really resonated with me. You know, I mean, my mom and dad are working so hard for me and for their life still counted, of course. And they did many great things, but, it's all for you, son. And so you better do something right. It was my thinking. And you better take respect what your parents did. And as we become less and less, as you know, struggle really builds character. Yes. And as things become easier and easier, there's less character building going on. And people today tend to phone things in. You know, even in, it used to be when you were in the studio, they'd be like, that sucks, do it again. Now they're like, that sucks. Okay, it's good enough. We can fix it.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so, but it's the times we live in, and you got to take the good with the bad, you know. So, but yeah, that, I think my work ethic really came from my parents who, you know, my dad said if my grades ever slipped, he'd send me to military school and I'd have to get it. So, you know, I believed him.
Yeah.
I believed him. I don't think he was bluffing. So
that's yeah. great, man. You know, I see. I grew up in New York City when you were talking about. You
oh,
know,
okay.
And so I grew up with people from all over, and that is pretty consistent about people that come here from another country. I mean, my wife's from another country. She's from England. It's not dramatically okay. different, but she came here to get opportunities. You know, long before we, you know, 5-6 years before we met. So I totally get that, man. And I understand what you're saying, and that's great, man. I'm sure your folks super proud of you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Let's talk about your new album, Peace, Love, and Loud Guitars. I love the title. Certainly, it's something that the world can use a lot more of, especially today. I never really ask about titles because it's cliched, but it's I like that, man. It's really it's like warm, and I was curious, was there a specific significance for you in it?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. This album is a lot in my career. I feel like the highest form of artistry is when you can write a song about humanity or making a difference in the world or peace or changing the world. You look at a guy like Paul McCartney. Mm. Okay, this guy's done everything.
Sure.
I mean, he invented the wheel. and they asked him, you know, out of everything you've done, what are you, you know, what really resonates with you? And he talked about all the songs the Beatles wrote about love and how they really impacted society. And so, you know, for a guy that's done everything, if that's what he's taking away from it, it's pretty much the highest form of artistry in the music that we do.
Yeah.
And in my career, I've really tried to do that. And sometimes I've gotten, I wouldn't say preachy, but, you know, putting my fist on the table with it, you know. And on this album, I thought that we're so polarized right now as a society and we're living in heavy times, not only in the United States. I mean, when we go to other countries, they're like, wow, things are really tense and not everybody's getting along. And so I felt like there's a lot of humor on this album. I just felt the need to keep things light. And then in one or two spots, you know, if we're laughing together, laughing disarms people and it opens them up. And then instead of slightly putting a message out there, and Peace, Love, and Loud Guitars is that. It's not like, F you, we need peace, or, you know, you got to get your shit together, world, you know. It's more or less, you know, it could have been, you know, peace, love, and hair grease, or peace, love, and, you know, cats and dogs, you know.
Yeah.
It sort of says what it's got to say, you know, in a way that is very relaxed for the times that we're living in. And so I feel like in this one, instead of writing, you know, half dozen songs that are talking about a noble subject, I would just limit it to one or two and then just do it in a real relaxed way. But that might get the message out in a more well-received manner. Let's put it that way.
And man, I think it's great that you have put your fist on the table at times because, you know, this is coming from your heart. And I think music should do that. I think people should try to do things with their music, you know, as long as it's honest. Like if it's right. bullshit, then it, you know, then it doesn't count. But so I think that's great, man. And like I said, I think the world could use peace and love for sure. That is a major thing.
Yeah.
Man, your vocals are really super passionate and you've got a great voice, especially for, you know, a blues artist. I was curious, do you enjoy singing or is it more of a necessity that you just happen to be good at?
Well, I love singing. And to me, I love it as much as the guitar.
Oh.
Yeah, I think because singing is such a, well, first of all, you know, you're given your own individual instrument. So everybody's, you know, when I play guitar, I play a Strat or a Les Paul, and so does the kid next door, you know. But All our voices are such a unique, one of a kind instrument, and to learn how to play it and maximize it. And I'm glad that I play guitar because I'm able to think of things in terms of tone, like I would on a guitar. I can sing sometimes like I'm playing, picking closer to the bridge or closer to the neck, or how I phrase things sometimes. So it's something I've worked very hard at, and I love, and I love listening to good singers sing as much as I love listening to good guitar players. I love Paul Rodgers and Rod Stewart and Otis Redding and Wilson Pickett and Steve Marriott, and you know, just these guys that put the blood on the microphone, man.
I like that expression.
I love singing. You know, in the beginning, I started singing because nobody wanted to sing in my band.
Right.
I was like, why don't you want to sing, man? I want to put a band together. They're like, dude, you're going to take a 120-bar guitar solo. Like, that's what the blues is in the middle of the song. What am I going to do there? Just stand there? I said, well, I don't know. They didn't want to suffer through long guitar solos, so I had to do the job myself.
Yeah, well, you do it great, man. Your voice is really very cool.
Thank you.
You know, you're welcome. You know who I love? You ever heard Nick Gravanides? He used to sing with Mike Bloomfield.
Absolutely.
And he's got one of the sweetest voices ever, man. I love that guy's voice.
Yeah, man. I actually read a lot of his interviews when I was doing my thesis on the racial evolution of blues. And just how, you know, how he got into blues, and, you know, he was, again, you know, a kid of an immigrant, and he didn't really feel like he fit in. Sort of the blues was the way that he fit into society, you know? So it was I'm very hip to him as an artist and his legacy within the blues genre.
Man, I'm glad you said that, because I had reached out to him and about coming on the show, because I really love what he does. And he got back to me, but I got to follow up with him because I'd love to have him on the show, man. He's where it's at.
Yeah.
Again, with the great work ethic, man, it's 12 songs on your record, almost an hour of music. Do you record live in a studio, old school style, or do you do like separate tracks here and there?
I do separate tracks and I go backwards.
What do you mean?
I play with a click track and I lay my guitar part down with nothing but a click track. And if that's got, there's, I can't hide behind one, a great drummer, you know, right. I got a click track going click, 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 click. And if my guitar moves me just going, you know, bam, doom, then I have a foundation, because I feel like I'm the solo artist in this project. So it seems like a lot of people sort of, it's like they let their band do the stuff and they add everything on top. I think that's backwards. I think that the band is supposed to support the artist.
Yeah.
But you have to give the band something to support. You know, how do you expect them to support nothing? You know?
How do you expect them to support nothing?
Yeah. You know, or they have to guess, you know, you go lay down the bass and drums first, and then they got to guess what you're going to play.
Yeah.
And I've had so many guys after they heard my record, they said, you know, Anthony, gosh, I wish I would have known you were going to play that, because I would have played something a little bit differently. So I thought, okay, well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to lay down with a click track all my vocals and all my guitar and my solos. Sometimes I recut a solo but they can totally react to this and they don't have to guess what I'm going to do. And they can find the little hole that, you know, might be between the guitar or the vocal that, you know, maybe the drummer can put a little thing in.
Sure.
Where when they're sort of cutting it with you, they don't know how it's going to sound, or they're in the moment and it may work or it may not work. So I didn't invent this process. I stole the idea from Mutt Lange.
Could got to be stealing ideas from
him. And he was thinking that, you know, he's such a perfectionist, not unlike myself, but, you know, he's to the, you know, 10th degree of perfection, but he's such a perfectionist, you know, he's even changing things, you know, guitar parts in the mix down, you know, but that was his feeling, is like, as soon as you put the rhythm section down, you're locked into that. And a big part of what I want to do is be the best songwriter that I can be and write actual songs in the idiom that I'm in the genre of blues rock. A lot of times we get accused of a song as just simply a vehicle for a guitar player to noodle all over. And I wanted to really play for the songs. I wanted to create songs. And I think that was the best way to do it. And and with the Beatles, Paul McCartney laid his bass down last. He was the last guy to play, so he could play all the melodies of the vocals and find the spots. Everybody goes, wow, he's such an amazing bass player. Yeah, because, yes, he was. And two, he also had the ability to play melodically because he was playing in response to all those things. So, you sort of have to have your stuff together to play with a click and do it the way that I did. I don't know early on in my career if I would be seasoned enough to do it that way.
Sure.
But with experience and studio experience and comfort, I really feel like that was the really cool way to do it.
That's really clever. Did you work with Mutt on any of your records, or what was your?
No, I just, I tried to study as much as possible going into this album. I really wanted this album to be, a big leap ahead from all the things that I've done in the past. So what I started to do was research. So what do the big record producers like Daniel Lanois do?
Yeah.
And Mutt Lange and all these people that are making some of the best albums of our era. And what did Phil Ramone do? And so you sort of study that everybody's got a work ethic. If you like rock and roll, I mean, Back in Black is the Bible of, it's the Bible of rock and roll. I mean, you could say it's a perfect record of rock and roll. So Mutt did that one, as he evolved in his career, he started to get more and more perfect sounding, which was, just his choice. But my taste and preference was with sort of the earlier stuff that was a bit more raw, and especially in the type of music that I do. But I loved his work ethic. Quincy Jones is another guy I studied. Yeah. And Quincy has this great philosophy where they would take the worst four songs on. They'd finish the record and they'd take the worst four songs and they'd say, okay, let's try to beat that. Now, on Michael Jackson's Thriller, they took the four worst songs and they had the four that they added after the record was done. One was Beat It. The other one was Pretty Young Thing. The third was Human Nature. And I can't remember what the fourth was. But they basically did an album and then they did another one. But these are the songs. Has anyone beaten this? Has anyone beaten song number 11? No. Okay. Let's go back until we get one that's better than 11. Okay. Well, and I did that with this record too. I probably demoed and sang 25 songs.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And one or two sort of, they came really close. But there's just something that just wasn't right about them. So I feel like I have a good half dozen ideas for the next album that I just didn't find the right way for them this time. So it's all that hard work's good. It's
yeah. Well, nothing's ever wasted. You know that.
Yeah. Yeah. Know? Exactly.
Wow, that's great. What you've such a big catalog. What about what happened? Did something happen, or what was all the triggers for you to suddenly say, or maybe not suddenly, but to say, hey, I want to, escalate this process?
Well, because I had a big catalog, I look at our merch table and I'm like, holy Christmas, look at all this stuff that's on this table. In today's market, you have to make a lot of noise. It's a noisy classroom and you got to make a lot of noise to stand out. So artists are releasing something every month. Here's our new single. Here's our new album. And I know some artists are releasing two albums a year. And after a few years of doing that, I don't care if, unless you're the Beatles where you have, amazing songwriting teams, it's going to be hard to be original and unique, and each album having its own thing. It's going to start turning into a machine press of albums. And I didn't want that to happen this time. I said, okay, man, I've already got 12 of these. I mean, you know, we play for a first time fan and they ask which one of these million albums am I going to buy?
Yeah.
So the thinking was, okay, let's make one. And maybe from this step forward, let's make ones that really, really count. So maybe I won't make one every year or every 6 months. Maybe I'll make one every 2 years or 3 years. But yeah. I'm in the game for a long time. You know, it's not like a blues. The great thing is you get to be in the game for years. You know,
yes,
until your 60s and 70s.
Very cool, man. Hey, I want to talk about a couple of songs on the new record. The first one I'll talk about is called Blues in the First Degree. It's a really powerful blues rock anthem. And, you know, for me, at least as a guitar player, I felt it was like one of those songs where, man, you cannot help but pick up your guitar and play alongside this one. It's just that kind of a cool vibe. And, man, you were ripping, you know... The solo has some very cool, you know, Van Halen-like licks.
Right.
And you execute, man, flawlessly on those. Are you playing your V on there, or what are you playing on there? What guitar?
I was playing a 66 Strat that I put a humbucker in. So just a one humbucker, really an Eddie Van Halen sort of deal. Wow. Where I had a 250K pot. And I really like one humbuckers or one pickup in general in guitars. Yeah,
really?
I find that they have a more pure tone, and I like taking the tone knob out of there. I find that it just gets in the way of really pure tone. I think less is more in that way. So I would love to have a Strat with just one neck pickup in it.
That's wild.
Yeah, man, it was pretty cool. I did a bunch of experimenting on guitars and stuff, and I know there's a couple of purists and guitar collectors that are just gasping when they heard that.
Yeah,
a humbucker in a 66.
Dude, that's what I was thinking. Like, wow, this guy's got a set of big balls. You take a 66 Strat, and let me take it apart and put a humbucker. I'm like, wow, that is
balls. There's a small brain.
Whatever, man. That was pretty. That's a first.
Well, the body was refinished. I did a little bit of research, and it's like, okay, the body's refinished, so this guitar is worth X amount of dollars.
Yeah.
Route a refinned body, it's probably going to depreciate the guitar by $500 to $1,000.
Not much. Yeah.
And I thought, I'm never selling this thing. So, it's not like I just casually walked in there and said, yeah, you know. I'll tell you, I had a guy that does my guitar stuff. He's like, dude, I've been playing this guitar for an hour. And I would say on this new album, I recorded 80% of the solos with that guitar. It's amazing. It's amazing. And it was great as a single coil guitar, but it really came to life with this thing in it. And I went from thinking that it could be arguably the most stupid thing I've done, and to probably just a lucky stroke of brilliance, you know. So I'm glad that it all worked out. I would have hated if it would have sucked.
No, it sounds great. What pickup did you put in there?
I put in a Seymour Duncan Antiquity.
Oh, you know what, man? Yeah. I am smelling Anthony Gomes' signature line here, bro.
Bring it on, bring it on.
Seriously, man, everybody's always looking for something new, right? And like what?
Right.
And you know who, do you know Dave Amato?
I know of Dave, yes.
So Dave's signature guitar with Gibson is a single humbucker with a Floyd.
Wow.
Yeah, so I'm thinking, man, Fender needs to do a single humbucker. There you go, man. The Anthony Gomes model. Yeah, well, let's do it.
Yeah.
The distortion in there, is that coming from a pedal or is that just general amp overdrive?
I used a Kemper on the entire recording.
Very cool, man.
Yeah. So it's sounded all great. Sort of from the head. Thank you.
Yeah,
thank
sounded you. Really good. And the other song I really liked on there, I liked a bunch of them, but Take Me Back Home. I thought that was a great song to close the record out. You know, 5.5 minutes of killer stuff. Were you playing that same guitar? Because you had a clean tone in there and it sounded great.
Yeah, the outro solo is that guitar that we were just talking about. Wow. And the clean tone was a hardtail American Standard with noiseless pickups in it.
Okay.
And for whatever reason, I know that doesn't sound sexy at all. I tried my 65 Strat and it was too menacing. Yeah. For a tone, even with a single coil. So I tell you, I really like those noiseless hot pickups by Fender, the same kind that Jeff Beck uses. I think that they're awesome and there's no noise.
Yep.
And for recording, they're just really tremendous. They got a lot of bite, but they have some balls too. So, yeah.
No, I have a Jeff Beck, not the custom one, but the Jeff Beck standard guitar with the noiseless pickups, and I love it. Not only does it sound good, it's just such a great, easy guitar to play, man. So I'm with you on that, man.
Yeah.
At the end, the solo has just some slight breakup. Was that? Oh, that's from the Kemper. I'm sorry. I was going to ask you what.
Yeah.
Same thing. So, the lyrics: "Take me back home. I've been lost and broken." That was pretty intense, man. Is there like a backstory to that, or?
Well, you know, we've all had tough times in our lives. All of us have, you know, and I think as a true artist, you're able to take whatever tough time that you've had and emote that. It's like an actor, a really good actor that makes you feel something, has lived something in their life. They may not have been a car wash attendant, you know, whose father died, but they may have had some sort of grief that they're able to channel. And when they play that character, you know, the song was very, in many ways, an honest, basically the song is about our mortality, you know, and it's about the one great thing I like about getting older is you grow into the person that you were meant to become. And thank you, David Bowie. I stole that quote from David Bowie.
Yeah, I'm just writing that down, man. I like that.
Yeah, he's a pretty heavy cat. So, and I find that, and that's what I love about being an artist. The older I become, if you keep your head on straight and work hard, and you try to be healthy, mind, body, and soul.
Sure.
You can get better, and you can get deeper, and so. To me, that song is sort of, in some ways, just maybe in my 30s or whatever, I could have done some things a little bit differently. And maybe I stayed at the party a little too long. Nothing too crazy, you know, nothing like that. But, you know, when you're in a band, man, it's pretty exciting. And people get excited when they see you because they only see you once a year. And, you know, there's nothing more euphoric than playing a gig, and then you see your friends you haven't seen, and then you have a few cocktails and sure. Blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I think I was spending too much time doing that, you know, and now when we do gigs, I try to be very quiet after the show. Every now and then, when my friends are there, you know, we'll tip back a few and have some fun. But, I try to be probably as boring as possible because it serves the greater art, you know.
I know exactly what you're saying. Yeah, man.
Yeah, you know, I'm not hung over the next day, and I'm able to, you know, receive something, a song or an idea, or it's just sort of I got that idea from boxers. Like when boxers train, you know, they do all sorts of things. They don't drink. They, you know, they do this, they do that, and they try to get in the peak place.
Yeah, I totally get you.
Yeah.
Do you work out? Do you take care of yourself, like health wise and stuff?
Or yeah, good? You know, I believe it or not, this summer I started to work out, doing cardio and stuff.
Great.
You know? Man, I was like, wow, I'm finally here at the gym. This is crazy. I was trying to tie a string with a donut to the end of the treadmill to sort of inspire me. But I've just been touring a lot lately, so it's sort of hard to get into that routine when you know you get 6 hours of sleep. And, but when we gig, I'm very, very active. You know, I had a Fitbit on. I put it on a gig just for fun. It load in, gig, load out. 10 miles.
Get out. Dude, what do you do? What the hell? What are you running all over the...
Pretty much, man. Like,
That's awesome, man. 10 miles?
Yeah. And, you know, it's funny because part of the reason why I went working out is like, I felt like I was more flat-footed on stage than I had been. And I was getting comfortable being flat-footed. And I was like, no, man. You know, you got to put on a show for these people. So, and I've been spending a lot of time in the tour, in the studio. So touring a little bit less, maybe doing 8 shows a month for a few months instead of like 15. So that, and you know, sitting down in the studio, whatever. So, but yeah, it got me back in shape, and I was like, wow, I'm doing better shows than I've ever done. And I'm not out of breath when I'm singing. You know, I can hold this note.
That's awesome.
Like Jim Carrey and Pet Detective, you know, it's like great.
No, man, physical. I've been taking care of myself for like a long time, and it really pays off. I agree with you 100%. You feel better. You perform better and everything, you know, so.
Yeah, and you know you're supposed to be working out.
Yeah,
you
of course.
Know this. You know you're supposed to do it, and you can cheat every now and then. You can skip a day, or you can have a slice of pizza every now and then. But if that becomes your day-to-day routine, then now we all know better, you know.
Absolutely.
So when you're there, you're like, "Okay, man. Okay, I'm all right. I'm doing what I'm supposed to. I know what I should be doing." So
good for you, man. Congratulations.
Thank you, man. Likewise for you that you have a good balance like that.
Thanks. Hey, you've had such a long, successful career. What would you say, if you can even pick this out, what would be the top 3 experiences you've had musically, either because of the work you did or the hang or the personalities involved? What would be your top 3?
Well, the coolest thing would be B.B. King. He's my mentor. When I was in college writing my thesis, I would go to a jam night on Thursday nights and play blues. And if you play, they would give you a free beer for jamming. Mm. And if you jammed really well, they give you 2 free beers. And when you're in college, that's like $1 million.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's like, yeah, okay, I got my free beer and I'm going to nurse this all night and listen to people jam. And so there I was a 2 beer night. I was playing pretty well, you know, for where I was. And this guy comes up to me and he goes, "Who's your favorite guitar player?" And I could have mentioned Jimi Hendrix, B.B. King, Albert King, Jeff Beck, whatever. I mean, I could have gone on, you know, Ritchie Blackmore, Eddie Van Halen. I could have said any one of those guys because they're all sort of tied for first place in their own way. But I said B.B. King, you know, and in many ways, B.B. is my favorite in so many different ways. But he said, "That's interesting." And I thought so. "I'm B.B.'s bus driver and I want to introduce you to him."
Holy shit. How random is that?
Oh, and you, dude, the place I was in was like, oh man. I mean, there were every shady character was frequenting this place, right? So I was like, God, he may be, or he just may be insane. I don't know if this guy's really his bus driver. So, and then his name was Lamar Sanford. He was a Caucasian guy, and his name was Lamar Sanford. I've never met a Lamar Sanford in my whole life aside from this guy.
Right.
And I'm thinking, isn't that the dude's name from Sanford and Son?
But no, that's George. Lamont and George was the name. Yeah.
But I'm like, Lamar, you know. So anyway, so he goes, I want you to come to the show, mention my name and your name, and there'll be 4 tickets for you, front row. And I'll introduce you to B.B. after the show. So I call my friends up. I go, "Hey, do you want to maybe go see B.B. King today?"
So that's cool.
So we go there, and there are 4 tickets. And I dressed up like I was going to church or meeting the Pope. I wore suit pants and a vest and a nice shirt. I had little business cards made up that said Anthony Gomes, electric guitarist. You know,
that's good for all this you, stuff. Man. You were going to church, and you were going to meet the Pope, man.
Oh, I was, man, definitely. So, a couple of things struck me. One, how gracious this man was, even before I met him. I had to wait 90 minutes because he wanted to know who wanted to meet him, and he wanted to say hello and sign a picture for them.
Wow.
So you would go up, meet him at a table. It was very like professionally done. And he would say, hi. And they go, hey, oh, BB, la, 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 you're the greatest ever. And he, oh, thank you. Which of these two photos do you like the best? He had a headshot and a full body shot. And he had big stacks of both. And they'd say, oh, I like that one. And he would take it and he would sign his name. Thank you so much for coming. Then he'd meet somebody else. I'm like, you got to be kidding me. And his bus driver said, oh, we got to lie. We got to tell him that these are just the only people that want to meet him. He'll be here to 3 a.m. And at that point, he was late 60s or something.
Holy crap.
He goes, oh, yeah. And then his health will suffer and he'll get tired. Oh, no. I mean, we got to limit it to 90 minutes. And they would shuffle these people backstage, you know. And Lamar asked that I wait for BB to meet with all these people. And then Lamar said, BB, this is the young guy that I was talking to you about that I saw yesterday. And BB took about half an hour with me.
Really?
Yes. And he started to tell me all the things about running a band and being a band leader and staying away from Anthony, you know, you seem like a fine young man, but you know, I've seen drugs and alcohol, you know, ruin a lot of people's lives. So please stay away from that. Oh, okay, BB, absolutely. Great. Now, when you have a band, you're going to have to make decisions on the musicianship in your band. And you might find a guy that's a really good musician, but he's not that reliable, or he's not a great guy, but he's so good on his instrument. And then you may get another guy that's not so as good on his instrument, but he's just a really great guy. He said, Anthony, what I've learned is 100% of a man, that's 70% of a musician you can work with, and you can make them maybe not 100, but 90, 95. 70% of a man, that's 100% of a musician, will always be 70% of a man.
Wow.
So I'm like, okay, you know, and just, you know, just things like this. Okay. And I said, oh, wow. You know, and I studied a lot on BBN, my thesis, you know, a lot of, but I had so much respect for him, not only as a musician. I mean, anybody that plays with vibrato, you know, we talk about Eddie Van Halen and tapping. Mm-hmm. Well, anybody that plays vibrato, it's pretty much because of BB King.
Sure.
You know, they used to do the wimpy little vibrato before him, you know, and he really defined. So, I mean, everybody that plays guitar, whether or not they realize it, owes so much to this man. And so I had so much respect for him as a guitar player, as a singer, as a band leader, all the things he had to do in the 50s and 60s being African American to be successful. But then beyond that, the ambassador that he was for the blues, to make it include everybody in all colors and all shapes and sizes. I mean, I was just so blown away by him as a person. And so, yeah. And then I remember, man, I gave him my card, you know, and he said, is it all right if I keep this?
Like, what a guy. Talk about knowing how to make somebody feel like $1 million, man.
Oh, yeah. I remember I said, yeah, I said, BB, I said, I got 1,000 of them. Yeah, not a problem. You know, it wasn't like I made or 500. I made 500 cards. I probably gave away 7 in my whole life.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I was just starting out at that point. And, you know, I'll tell you, the next day I went and told my dad that I wanted to be a professional musician. Which was something that I was struggling to do for a long time.
To tell him that.
And I thought, you know, so many artists and you know, if there's people listening now, believe in your dreams, man, believe in them. If you work hard, they can come true. You just got to work at it and but believe in your dreams. And it's so many of us don't do that, and we get scared and we end up doing things that we don't. And I was so fortunate that B.B. King, I mean, he believed in me. This little punky kid from the suburbs of Canada, he believed in, and that gave me such the courage.
That's great,
do,
man.
Yeah. And you know, later on, in, we kept in touch, and we opened up for him several times, and we did a couple little legs of some tours, and it was really, really wonderful, you know. And he was so loving and so, yeah, I've, you know, a couple of real quick B.B. King stories, not to get too boring about
No, it's cool.
The next time I met B.B. was the first time I was in Europe, and we were on a blues festival in Norway, and there was like a ton of bands, you know. B.B. King was on top, and in the very fine print at the very bottom was my name. And second from the top was Robert Plant. Robert Plant wasn't really touring, but he put together this little band to do this festival in Norway just because he wanted a gig. Things in Europe are interesting that way. They do things a little bit more, especially 20 years ago or 15 years ago, under the radar, you know. Like when you come to the States, it's sort of a real polished big production, but they may do a one-off here and there, and it's just sort of a fun thing. So Robert Plant was my next door neighbor in my hotel, and kept on running into each other. And and the dude's tall, man. Most of the people I've ever met, the first thing I think of is, Lord, you are short. Robert Plant was a tall dude. And so Clapton's pretty tall too. But everybody else I met, I'm like, oh God, you're tiny. You know, so we kept on running into each other in the hall, and then we're running into each other backstage, and I'm talking with Robert Plant about blues for half an hour. And I lived in Chicago at this time. So he was just, he's so enamored about Chicago. Oh, yeah. And he's asking me all these questions. He goes, do you know this guy? I go, yeah, I know him. He was at a jam night on Tuesday night. He goes, oh man, you should have seen this guy in the 60s. Oh my. And you know, and I was like, whoa, this guy really loves music. You know what I mean? We were just having this really deep conversation about music. And so this guy comes to me and he goes, do you want to meet B.B. King? Robert and Anthony, do you guys want to meet B.B. King? And I'm like, oh, yeah, yeah. Robert's like, oh, I'd love to. So I'm waiting in this very small line with Robert Plant to meet B.B. King.
That's really cool.
Which is really cool. So they call both of us in, and B.B. looks at me and he smiles, and you know, he's just so happy to see me, you know. And then he looks at Robert, and then he looks back at me, and it's a totally different guy looking back at me. It looks like he just bit into a sour lemon.
Why?
And he goes, well, Anthony, you're here, you made it. Nothing I can tell you anymore, except one thing, stay away from drugs.
Oh.
he thought that Robert, he didn't like that I was hanging out with Robert Plant, because he thought that he was going to corrupt me somehow. I didn't see Robert even sip any booze, you know, but he was probably thinking back to
his reputation probably preceded him. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm sure he probably met him back in 1971.
Yep.
You know, but anyway, and I'm thinking, God, Robert Plant is totally ruining my cred.
with B.B. King.
Yeah, yeah. And there's a great, I have three photos on in my office. I'm not one of those people that ever hangs an award or anything relating to myself in my home. That's not really a thing for me, but I have three small photos, and one is with me and Jeff Beck. One's with me and Paul Rodgers, and one is with me and B.B. King. And that photo was taken by Robert.
Oh, wow.
So it's a real cool memento. So
that's great.
So yeah, man. And then, you know, so that's in the beginning of when my career starts taking off. And then a few years later, we're opening up for B.B. and we're doing a bunch of dates. It's not just a one-off. We're doing them, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 dates. And every time I met B.B., I was in awe of him, and I still was, but he was becoming like my adopted grandfather or something.
Sure.
You know, we were just really getting, you know, hey, how's it going today? Great, great. And so he goes, Anthony, he goes, how's the tour going? How do you like the tour? I said, BB, I hate it. It's awful. I'm not having a good time at all. Well, he was so shocked. He said, what's wrong? I said, I'll tell you what's wrong. My friends are coming here. Then they watch you play and they know where I steal all my licks from. I said, it's embarrassing. I am not having a good time at all. Well, he laughed, you know, and he said, look, he said, don't say steal. Say borrow. And he explained all the people where he got all his stuff from. Lonnie Johnson and T-Bone Walker and Blind Lemon Jefferson. And he said, people don't really know these people. And they think that I made up their, I took what they did and put my own thing on it. But they think that I made up everything and I didn't. And he was really great at explaining how he came to his recipe, you know, in a real unintimidating way, because I mean, it's BB freaking King, you know? And then, so just being around that made me go, oh, wow, this is pretty heavy and this is pretty cool. And yeah, you know, just very loving and supporting. And he would say things like, Anthony, the blues are like the laws of the land. They have to be amended to the times we live in.
Wow, that's heavy.
That's heavy. And he said, you know, young people today, Anthony, like yourself, you got to play the blues that you want to play. I did the blues how I wanted to do it. You got to do it the way that you want to do it. And I know you'll find the blues in it, but you know, you got to do what makes you happy. And it was very, you know, for the guy that all the traditionalists, who sometimes despise me for love, they should heed his words a little bit more, you know? So yeah, man, it was, so that was the greatest of all experiences. And you know, strangely enough, when he passed away, it was on my birthday.
Wow. That is weird.
Yeah. You know, but I really felt a connection to BB on so many different levels. You know, I also got to jam on his 80th birthday with him on stage, which was pretty cool. You know, and yeah, man, it was all those things wrapped up into one are undeniable first place. Another great experience I had was hanging and talking with Jeff Beck.
Oh my God.
I'm not trying to name drop for anybody listening. I am just a music fan and a nerd, and you know, these guys are my superheroes. So I'm just lucky enough that I get to meet them because I know somebody in the band or whatever, you know. Jeff Beck to me is the greatest. In my opinion, he's the greatest alive. And you know, as far as avant-garde guitar playing, you know, him and Jimi Hendrix to me wrote the book.
Yeah.
And you know, there've been other guys since then that have added great chapters to this book, but you know, they're like the founding fathers of pushing guitar to its limit.
I agree.
And yeah, and he's like Yoda, you know. So I mean, I've met other great guitar players that are in the top 10 of great guitar players of all time, and yeah, you know, I'm listening to what they're saying, absolutely. But when Jeff says it, I mean, he could tell me to play wrong notes and I would start playing.
Sure.
Wrong.
Yeah.
You know,
well, the thing is with that guy, there is no wrong note. That's what's amazing about Jeff Beck.
You know, and so it was interestingly enough tied into BB King. They played, my girlfriend bought me tickets for my birthday. To see Jeff Beck a couple days after my birthday. And that was the same birthday that BB had passed.
Hmm.
So in his set, he did Thrill Is Gone, to me, which was the highlight of his show, because he sounded like BB King and Jeff Beck. How do you do that? You know? So I said, you know, Jeff, we started talking about BB King. Okay. You know, so that was a real icebreaker because we both had such tremendous admiration for him and sincere admiration. So, you know, that really broke the ice and said, man, you know, you sounded like yourself and BB. And he goes, well, you know, BB has a few things that he does, but why do it just like him? You know, because you should try to do your own thing on it. I'm like, yeah, writing notes. Okay. do your own thing on it. Don't sound just like them, you know? And I said, yeah, I said, you know, and it really moved me in the simplicity of the thing. I said, you know, you did some wonderful things all night. But wow, that really, there was something about it. And he said this to me, and every now and then I'm playing live and I, you know, sometimes I, you have that voice that, you know, in your head, you know, usually mine goes, stop sucking, stop sucking. but the voice is his that, you know, he said, you know, you can literally play a guitar solo with two notes. The whole solo, you just change inflections and the way you touch it and where you place the note. And I did it. And, you know, you can tell it when you're engaged with the audience, if they're paying attention. And sometimes when you sit on two notes for a while, it really makes them all of a sudden start paying attention. And it's really moving. And I just went, whoa. So, and, you know, he said some other things in the discussion about guitar and stuff where it was just, it was so inspiring. And I would say that began my journey in my previous album, Electric Field Holler, had only been out for 2 months. And talking with Jeff, you know, when you look in the mirror, you know, and you say, yeah, you know, this is about as good as it's going to get. You know, I could grow a mustache. I could lose 5 pounds. But, you know, this is what I got to work with. And I'm okay with it. Well, I was feeling that way about my guitar playing, you know, and, you know, I've been doing this a while. You know, this is sort of my bag. And after talking with Jeff, I was so inspired. I went to thinking that I was 16 again. I was that same 16-year-old in my bedroom practicing.
That's really cool.
I realized there wasn't enough hours in the day to practice. Oh, what time I had squandered away, not realizing the joy and discovery of music. Oh, my God. Whoa, I was so blown away by that conversation and being with a man of that depth. And I started pulling out some of the 80s records I hadn't heard in 20 years. You know, Bark at the Moon by Ozzy. I mean,
great
you know,
record.
Yeah, you know, just stuff that you may not think somebody in my genre may listen to, you know, and also going back into some of my really, you know, sort of deeper blues things and just studying and just being excited. And I'm going through my old, going in the attic and getting the guitar for the practicing musician issues that I had from 1987. And you know, just going, hey, where was I when I was really in love with the guitar, you know, before it became my job? And I got back to that. And I think that excitement was also what prompted me to really push the boundaries of my playing. I wanted to be a more technical player and a cleaner player, and I wanted to be more soulful. I wanted to push both sides. I didn't want to choose. I didn't want to, I'm more of a field player, I'm, you know, by nature, but I didn't want to choose. I wanted to be more technical, and I didn't care if the blues purists were mad that I tapped. I don't know if anybody's really tapped on a blues album.
When I heard that, it's funny you mentioned that. I thought that it sounded great. It was totally appropriate. It was, I enjoyed it anyway. I thought it was great, but it was really cool to hear that, you know. It wasn't like it was a really, it was right, perfect for the song, man. I thought it was great, but it was different. And you don't hear that a lot. And I don't know why, because it's like, it was used appropriately, you know. It's like, it's not like you bought a Tommy gun to a knife fight or something. It was really appropriate, you know.
Well, thank you. So, you know, just I wanted to do those kinds of things, and that was inspired by Jeff, you know, in our conversation. Like, whoa, you know, and maybe he'll hear tapping and go, "Oh, that's horrible," but you know, I didn't inspire that, Anthony. But
no,
man. But you know, to me, like, it just opened my mind and my soul and my heart to just being excited by things and not put a barrier on creativity. And you know, that's something that Jeff is so magnificent at.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
It's nice to hear a story about him where it was positive, because, you know, you hear through the grapevine stories about, oh, Jeff is cranky. But none of these people, I don't take, I only take stuff from the source. None of these people have actually like sat and had a conversation, like been in a room with them where maybe he's been rude. It's like, oh, I heard my friend whose brother was a roadie for fill in the blank said,
right.
You know, so it's, and I'm like, okay, you know, but it's nice to hear some positive stuff about Jeff, cause he's certainly one of my favorite players too, man.
Oh, I've known a couple people who've met him and, they've had the same experience I have.
Yeah.
Yeah, man, I think, most people don't know this about him, but I caught on because we had spent a little time. He's very funny. But very dry.
That's really English. Dry. That's English humor, man. Yeah, that's English humor. Yeah.
So I don't know if sometimes people would just misunderstand, like, he's actually being funny. I don't know. That could be, you know, sometimes if you're really dry. And but yeah, man, I don't know what other experiences people have had, but I'll tell you, he couldn't have been more gracious. And I said, you know, and I the picture that I took with him, I said, could I trouble you to take a photo with you? And he said, well, no, we can't take a photo. You said it would be trouble. It's just, that would be too troubling. We can't do that. It was like Nigel Tufnel. You
know? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I'm like, oh, come on, let's just take the damn picture. You know, and then he took it and laughed, you know? So I think some people may have been intimidated or whatever, but he was just joking the whole way and just, just a cool dude. So it's nice.
That's awesome.
My heroes that I've met have been very gracious and very cool. And, you know, I sort of feel sorry for Jeff Beck though, because, well, every guitar player really wants to be Jeff Beck, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we all want to be that. We want to be Yoda.
Yeah.
But, you know, so my buddy introduces me to Jeff, and he goes, Jeff, Anthony's a very accomplished guitar player.
Oh, and my
Jeff
God.
Goes, oh, I'm sure he is. You know what I mean? But that's all Jeff Beck meets are guitar players that just idolize the guy. He's like, I would just really love to play for like a drummer maybe or a bass player or maybe an attractive young lady. I'd like to maybe say hello backstage, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's like a bunch of nerdy, sweaty guitar players. Oh, hey, Jeff, I'm a big fan.
Yep.
And then, you know, he's got to indulge us in guitar talk. But, it was just a really cool thing.
Very cool, man. Let me ask you this. What were some of the maybe the lower points or bigger obstacles that you had to deal with over your career? And how did you manage to sort of get through them? Either music related, personal, business, doesn't matter.
Well, I made a choice early on in my career where I wanted to be the type of artist that was always honest to my art and always make albums that I wanted to make. And our fans have liked some of the albums I've done better than others, but they know this about me, that I might not like this one, but he's being honest. And I may like the next one that comes around. Sometimes when you do that, you know, it confuses record companies. Why are you doing an acoustic record? Well, I want to do an acoustic record. I want to express this side of my creativity. Hmm. So sometimes they haven't been so up to following the muse of my creativity. And, you know, a great hockey player named Jaromir Jagr, who's I don't know if he's still in the NHL this year, but I think he's like in the top five all-time scoring players. And, you know, he was just a really great player. And he left the NHL for 3 years and played in Europe. And they were saying, oh, you might have been higher on the list if you'd stayed in the NHL and not gone to Europe those 3 years. Hmm. He said, I probably wouldn't be playing now.
Right.
You know, but that gave – I needed to do that, and now I'm still in the NHL, you know, in his 40s, like well up in his 40s. So I feel like because I followed my creativity, you know, this new album we're delivering has been well received, and it for the genre, it's very commercial, and – I think it's going to do well. And I think because I did an acoustic record 2 albums ago, I can do this one because I'm not stamping the same thing every time. So that's the resistance to that has been a challenge. Also, too, in my genre, I also decided that I was going to be an artist that would push things forward. And sometimes you have to wait for some people just to catch up to that. You know, we mentioned there's a tapping on this record. Oh, my God, there's going to be, I know, a certain element that already doesn't like me, but, you know, I'm signed, sealed, and delivered on the indictment there because because you know it's Muddy Waters wouldn't do that, and
he might have if he had ever seen it or heard of it. I mean,
what these people forget is the people that if they were living in the time that they celebrated, they would be against the music that they were celebrating.
Yeah, right.
Because Muddy Waters got booed for plugging in an electric guitar.
Right.
B.B. King.
So did Bob Dylan. Yep. Yep.
Yeah. B.B. King took the blues out of, you know, the back alley, put on suits, had horns. And then his biggest hit had a symphony playing on The Thrill Is Gone.
Yeah.
That's not gut bucket blues. And, you know, he really pushed things. And it didn't sound anything like Charlie Patton. And that's supposed to be blues. So, you know, all these guys have pushed the blues in different places. And unfortunately, there's a small group of powerful people that look at the blues this way. They look at it as the root of all music. And if it's influenced by the music that it inspired, then it's no longer the blues and it becomes that music. So saying this, if blues becomes too rockish, it's actually rock, and blues inspired rock.
Man, that's a very stressful life to live by so many definitions, man, to be honest with you.
Yeah, and it is. And my feeling is, hey, you know, I learned a lot from my dad, but there's one or two things that I taught him, you know, as a man. Well, you know, rock can teach blues one or two things, even though blues is the daddy of rock and roll. It can go that way, and we got to be open, you know. So I would just say right now I feel the most excited that in my genre that people either they've accepted that I'm not going to go away, or with time they're understanding better my objective, and maybe some of the earlier things I did, time is starting to catch up with them. It sounds less rocky now because everybody's more rocky, or what have you. So,
I listened to your. I didn't think anything. It's funny that, man. I think the people that do that are just like the people that troll shit on the internet. You know, like have nothing to do. It's really easy to be a critic. It's really hard to actually do stuff.
Yeah, you know? It's easier to burn the bridge down than build one. I remember my first. My third album that I made was a real breaking point in my career and took me to the next level. And I had to save $30,000 15 years ago or 16 years ago to make this album.
Wow.
I was running around in a van that was breaking down all the time because I couldn't afford a real van. I was putting in that year 100,000 miles on the road,
making
no money because I had to pay my band and going in the hole. And, you know, and all my friends are making six figures in their jobs.
Sure, sure.
And you know, looking at me like they never judged me, but, you know, I felt judged even though they didn't do that. And I get this review in a magazine at the time called Blues Review, and it said, another day, another hot shot, leather pants wearing guitar blues wannabe or something like that. And I was like, oh my God, they're not out there changing the tires, you know, once a week or getting up at 6 a.m. so you can take the truck to the mechanic so you can get back on the road by 10.
Yeah.
You know, they're not the one going into debt. And you know, why are they giving my album such a lousy review? And I know they gave three lousy albums a really good review. Those albums. So what I did was I took out a double page centerfold spread in the magazine and I put all our good press quotes from any press that we had that was positive, because we were getting some really good positive press. And interestingly enough, that was one of the big catalysts that broke my career. So is the two-page ad.
Good for you, man.
Yeah. So you never know, you know, never give up, never give up on your dream and never give up. And there's people that they're going to try to keep you down, you know, and they're not going to like what you do. But the way I look at it is, hey, you know, only a handful of people need to like you to be successful.
Right.
I mean, if you sell a million records, I mean, almost nobody sells a million records today, but 7 billion people could think you're the worst ever. You know, that's 1 million compared to 7 billion isn't that much. You know, so you only have to hit a small group to like what you do.
No, I agree. It's funny because my normal gig is I run a marketing company. I've been doing that for 20 years. And in 2009, I wrote a book on marketing, selling, ad copy, and it came out. And most, it was really, you know, well received. But, you know, I had a bunch of people that would make comments on like marketing forums. And I thought to myself, man, if you were busy, you wouldn't be on this forum. You'd be actually work. Why are you on this forum all day? You know, and right. So like from that point on, I realized that most people that are critics aren't really doing anything on their own, you know,
right,
outside of that. And I don't really find that it's like taking advice from the overweight trainer in the gym.
Right.
You know, so like what is this? What is your frame of reference to be even telling me? You know what I mean? So it's like,
right,
man, that shit's tongue in cheek. Everybody's willing to, you know, criticize.
Well, you know, it's funny because my dad comes from Portugal and I would always hear these old world sayings, you know, like and my dad would always tell me them. And then he'd always say, well, they sound better in Portuguese because they rhyme. And, you know, one was fish starts to smell bad after 3 days. So that means that if you go visit somebody, don't go for more than 3 days to somebody's house or crash at somebody's house.
That's funny.
You know, and fish smells bad after 3 days. Well, you know, Portugal's right on the Atlantic Ocean,
uh-huh.
You know, so, you know, they're a big fishing community. So that was the saying. Well, another one my dad would say is nobody has made a statue for a critic.
Yes, man.
So, that was, I wonder how that rhymes in Portuguese. But anyway, so yeah, man, you know, just put a little love in what you do. And Santana once said that if you don't like somebody's guitar playing, learn to play like they do, and I guarantee you will have more respect and admiration for what they do.
Yeah, man. Absolutely. I've been to Portugal. It's actually beautiful there. Have you been there?
Yeah, man.
Isn't it nice?
Oh, it's amazing. It's an amazing country. What kills me is, aside from on the East Coast of the U.S., it doesn't happen, but most times my name gets misspelled or mispronounced as Gomez with a Z because Spanish.
Yeah.
You know? And what happened was Portugal and Spain, you know, were two superpowers in the, you know, 15th, 16th century. I mean, they were America and the Soviet Union back in that time. You know what I mean? They were the two superpowers. So, if you were Portuguese, you had an S at the end of your name. And if you were Spanish, you had a Z.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and those were fighting words, Bubba. I mean, those.
Oh, for someone to call you Gomez.
Oh, my God. Yeah, I'm not Spanish. Are you kidding? Yeah, yeah. I mean, of course, I don't look at it that way. But any Portuguese last name will have an S. So Lopez is Lopes.
Yep.
But for whatever reason, people have a real challenge with, you know, the S here, except on the East Coast in the United States where they know what it is. So we're playing in Portugal and a big blues festival. And I go, oh, finally, I know here they won't spell my name wrong. And I'm on the Portuguese airline. It's called TAP, T-A-P. I don't know if it stands for Transatlantic Portugal or whatever, but I open up, you know, they have those magazines in the plane. And there is a big thing for this blues fest that we're doing, and they spell my name with a Z.
No.
In the motherland. And I guess I ended up talking to the festival guy, and he said, I guess they just thought you were from the States, so they thought it must have a Z. Oh man, it killed me. It was, I mean, I laughed, you know what I mean?
But totally,
it was
like, get that.
Yeah. It was funny. It was funny.
That's wild. Hey, let's talk about gear for a few minutes.
Sure.
Is as far as go-to guitars, is that your, the 66 Strat with the humbucker? That would be it then?
Oh man, I have a few go-tos. I have a Les Paul Heritage that's really, really sweet. I know some people at a music store, and you know, Gibson has had, let's say, throughout their career, varying degrees of quality control.
Totally.
And some people may say that recently it's not as good as it was in the past. But I, you know, every now and then a real winner comes in, and man, this guitar just sings. And I have a
what is a Heritage? I never even heard of that.
It's sort of like a fancy. I think Heritage is basically another word for high dollar. So they're like $5,000 or something.
But oh, okay.
You know, they're supposed to be, you know, and boy, I mean, this thing is just, I mean, it's so amazing. And I have a Tele with humbuckers, a thin line Tele with humbuckers. And I used those two for a lot of the rhythm. And I used, and they're both of those guitars, along with the 66, really speak. I have a 65 Strat that really speaks, you know. So, and my V, I just got into Vs. My V's a killer, man. I love that. So,
what year is that? Is that an older one?
It's 2001.
Okay.
Yeah. And
so that would be like, you know, super vintage if you're selling it on eBay like everybody.
right, exactly. But you know, 2001, 2002, there were, you know, the V's were particularly good in that year. So I was on the hunt,
yeah,
for one. And this thing just plays so well, and it sounds great. And I can't believe I got to the party so late with the Flying V. I just love that guitar.
Are you you said you're tall?
No, I'm about 5'11".
Yeah, because when I saw photos of you at the V, it looked like it, you know, I think you got to be a little taller to have the V look right on you, right. You know, and you look like, well, 5'11", I'm 5'9", so 5'11" is taller than me. So, you know, I said, okay, this guy must be tall, because it looks like it sits well on you, man. And it's an awkward guitar for many people, I think.
Yeah, you know, and I really stayed away from it for that reason. And then it went in my hands and I was like, oh man, let me get my Michael Schenker records. This is bad. I mean, it was very cool, man. I was like, wow. Yeah. I really love it. I think it's one of those things, it's a love hate thing. Either you love it and it works for you, or it doesn't.
Sure. Is there anybody that influences your playing that people might be surprised to hear?
I don't know. You know, one guy who I love that everybody likes, but I don't think ever gets mentioned enough, is Billy Gibbons. I really love Billy Gibbons. I think he's a guy that, you know, but I don't think people would be shocked about that. I'm a huge Ritchie Blackmore fan.
Hmm.
Really, you know, I love any sort of guitar. Tommy Emmanuel, anybody that plays the instrument well. It doesn't have to be necessarily my genre, per se. You know, I love everything, like even that 80s sweep picking and, you know, Steve Vai or anything like that. I mean, I'm very open to as a guitar player.
Cool, man.
Yeah, man. Anybody who plays with passion and personality, I'm really into.
Desert Island Discs, top three, no particular order. And just for today, knowing like even 10 minutes from now, they could change. What would you
right.
Need
your really, reaction? You're really trying to kill me here.
that's a tough question.
Oh my God. Well, I got to say Electric Ladyland. Just turns 50 this week.
The album turned 50 or you turned 50?
No, the album turned 50.
Oh, I didn't know that. You know, that's my favorite Hendrix album as well.
Yeah. Yeah. The thing I love about that album is Chaz Chandler's imprint is still on it, even though he wasn't there, with the songs being concise. But it's also allowed Jimmy more room to expand and solo and jam, but it didn't get too out of hand either. And yeah, man, I love that album. I love everything about that album.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and I collect vinyl, and I have every different cover of the album.
Isn't that cover? I remember I got that as a kid. I went down to the Village, and I thought I was really young, and I was like, wow, this is so cool. It's got all these hot women on it, you know, with the double album open up. I loved that cover when I was younger.
And in Europe, most people don't know this. I didn't know this till I started collecting vinyl. There's another set of covers.
How are they different?
Well, first of all, they sold the album as two separate albums.
Oh, wow.
And one is a portrait shot of Jimmy. It's a very famous photo. He's got that hat on that he has with the purple band and the turquoise. And he's got some big, big medallion thing on it, if I'm remembering correct. But you'll see the photo and you'll be like, oh, that's very iconic.
With the acoustic guitar?
No. This is... it might have been from the same session, but no, it's just from the waist up shot, or maybe, you know, mid torso up. And then there's another really cool psychedelic looking thing that's like with the Statue of Liberty, and it's yellowish and planes and almost something like Axis Bold as Love. So later on, Google search, you know, it was on Track Records. That was the label that he signed to in the UK at first. So they issued these things in a different manner.
Man, you could tell your enthusiasm for like any like history related thing to music you like. That's really cool.
Oh man, yeah, I love that. I want to know as much about the artist as possible. I want to know as much about the music as possible, you know? So that would be album number one. Oh God, this is so painful. I would say Completely Well by B.B. King would be album number two. Oh man. And I would say number three would be the Jeff Beck Group Truth.
Yeah. Great record.
Yeah. You know, Rod Stewart, very underrated vocalist. It's so interesting because I'm a big Rod Stewart fan. And look, the dude's not hurting. Okay. He's super loaded. He was a sex symbol. Mm-hmm. He was but he could have been the next Robert. He could have been the Robert Plant.
Could have been.
He had the pipes and he always wanted to be in a band. He didn't want to be a solo guy. But he just sold lots of money, and he sort of remembered as the guy in spandex singing, "Do you think I'm sexy?
Do you think I'm sexy?" You know? Yeah.
But I mean, it's interesting because Paul Rogers, basically, I heard an interview with him, and he said, "You know, Rod Stewart is the guy we all copied. Robert Plant went to see this guy sing and hear him sing. Led Zeppelin went to see the Jeff Beck Group." He goes, "Where do you think they got their stuff?" He goes, "He was the most influential singer on us all. We all copied Rod, and then he went on to be a superstar, but nobody knows that side of his singing where he was a badass." And it's sort of like fate, despite him wanting to go in that route, just pushed him into superstardom. And
everybody should have that trouble.
Into trophy wife after trophy wife, and Lamborghini after Lamborghini, he's had to suffer. I really feel for the guy.
Yeah.
But it's just interesting how people can perceive things on the outside that have absolutely no, Glenn Campbell, people have a certain, you mentioned Glenn Campbell, and people have a certain impression. Well, this guy played on 50 of the top 100 rock and roll songs of all time as a session guitar player. The guy was a badass, and everybody thinks of the Rhinestone Cowboy, and he could outplay most guys with one hand tied behind his back. So it's just interesting, the impression that we get of people versus what they truly are.
Yeah, sometimes for sure, man. Hey, what's the most important things you've learned about yourself throughout your career experience and life in general?
Wow, that's a very deep question.
It is. I could ask you if you use 9s or 10s.
Yeah, I use 11s actually, and I suffer. I must be a glutton for punishment. I much prefer this question. Wow, I mean, it sounds so narcissistic to talk about yourself in that way and what you've learned about yourself. I guess I just learned that, you know, to trust and believe in yourself, you know, nobody cares about what you're going to do as much as you do. Mm-hmm. And you have to really care and love yourself and respect yourself. Of course, but not at the exception of loving and respecting others, you know. In a weird way, what I've learned through this time is just how important I am and just how unimportant I am. In the grand scheme of things, I'm just a little blip in the radar of whatever. But as a little blip, maybe I can try to do as much good as I can, you know. So love yourself and realize that you ain't shit at the same time.
No, I think that's a great answer, man. And I think that's so important, you know, because you got to, if you're not comfortable, if you don't love yourself, as you said, not at the expense of someone else, of course, but it's really hard to function in the world. It's really hard to move forward.
Yeah. And I've also seen what positivity does, what being positive.
Yeah.
You know, we're taught lessons in life, okay? The golden rule, treat others how you want to be treated. And when I was a younger man, I thought all of these virtuous things you do are for being a virtuous person. You're supposed to be a good person, damn it. So you do those things. What I've learned is, no, they make your life easier.
Yeah, man.
Being a good person makes your life easier. You're not sweating trying to remember all the lies you told or whatever, you know, what have you. It's if you try to do the right thing and be a good person, and I'm not saying I've always done it. I've made my fair share of mistakes. But the more you can grow into that person, the happier you're going to be, you know.
Man, I am tracking with you 100%. And when that ties into what you said earlier about as you get older, you grow into the person you're meant to become. And even if you're jaded or if you've been screwed over and you got a bit of a chip on your shoulder, fake it till you make it. Do good shit, even if you don't believe in it. And it's not going to take long for you suddenly to say, wow, this is I'm a lot happier. You know, this is a lot less stress.
Right. Yeah, man. And, you know, I learned so much from B.B. King. You know, he was so supportive to everybody. The only other person I met that's like that is my mom. Everybody loves my mom. And I said to my mom, I said, Mom, everybody loves you that meets you. Why is this? What, I mean, you know, she said, well, I never say anything negative about people. I always try to look at the good in people and acknowledge it. And I'm like, oh, okay. You know, BB made some white guy from the suburbs that he knew could play somewhat, but he hadn't heard me play, but his bus driver put in a good word. And he gave me the courage to do all these things and because he believed in me. And I'm trying my best to pay it forward. And you know, he just was surrounded himself in love, you know, and I think without sounding too much like a hippie, if you do that, good things happen.
Yeah.
And to you and around you. And,
yeah.
And it's a great thing.
You mentioned your mom. What's the most important thing your mom and your dad taught you?
If I don't keep it together, they'll kick my ass. They taught me, they brought me into this world, and they can sure as hell take me out. There was no participation prizes when I was growing up. I'll tell you that. You know, I didn't get the belt, but I came close a couple of times. You know, I mean, I didn't get it often. I mean, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
There was no, it was like, you know. My dad used to say, you know, I don't want to be your friend, Anthony. You got a lot of really great friends. I want to be your father.
Yeah.
It was like, yep. Oh my God, you sound like Darth Vader when you say that, Dad.
Yeah.
Do
you have kids yourself?
I don't. It just hasn't worked out. I would love to be a dad. It just hasn't worked out with where my career has gone and the timing of things.
Sure.
You know, that's something that I would, you know, I mean, it's late in life for me to have kids. It's not the, it's still possible. We'll see what happens. Yeah, that's something that I would really love, but I would want to be a very responsible father. And,
sure. It's a lot of responsibility, man.
Oh man, yeah, that's what everybody says, and it's hard to maintain a touring lifestyle with the amount of success that I've had. You know, I mean, if I was Rod Stewart, it'd be great. I could take a year off, be with the kid, and
yeah,
and then you know, record 9 to 5, and then come home, and then you know, go out for 3 months, and they can come along on a jet. You know, but that's not really the that's not where I'm at. So and I see people that are in my shoes that have families, and they do a wonderful job doing it. It's just that all the cards haven't fallen in line. So
yeah, man, if it's meant to be, it'll happen. You know that.
Yeah, exactly.
Two more questions, man, and I really appreciate your time. Toughest decision you ever had to make, or most difficult thing you've had to do?
Wow. Toughest decision I've ever had to make.
Or most difficult thing you've had to do?
Oh man, I'm sure that it's hard to. My God, well, I'll tell you, the hardest thing is if I've ever had to let a band member go. That's just really so emotionally grueling when you have to part company with somebody and you're the one that's initiating that.
Sure.
You know, that's the part of my job that I've hated to do, that I've had to do, every now and then. Yeah. So I would say that.
Cool. And, last question, man, and I want to talk about music as medicine, but what's been the biggest change in your personality, would you say, over the last like 10 years, and how much of that change has been deliberate and intentional on your part, and how much is just a part of aging?
Yes, I think part of it has been deliberate and part of it has been aging. The best thing that ever happened to me was turning 40. I stopped caring, you know. Before then, there was a real push. Okay, Anthony, you have the ability to cross over into the mainstream. And if we take enough pictures in the right light, you might look like you're in your 30s, early 30s. You know, you got to play this kind of music to cross over, but I really want to play the blues. Ah, man, no, you got to do this and you got to do that. And you got to wear this really stupid outfit. Okay, man, I'll do it. I just want to make it, man.
Yeah.
When I turned 40, I was like, fuck this.
Good for you.
This is for me. And I'm going to do this for me. And I started to take things seriously. One thing I did when I turned 40, inspired by boxers and people that got into shape, was that they would stop drinking for a while.
Mm.
So I stopped drinking for 90 days just to see what it would be like. And stupid me, I quit the week before my birthday.
It doesn't matter when you quit that thing, man. You know that.
Yeah. So the interesting thing I noticed was before I could order like a Crown Royal and Diet Coke and nobody'd say anything. But if I ordered a Diet Coke, they'd tell me that it was going to kill me. You know what I mean? It's like, okay. So now I'm on regular Coca-Cola, whatever I have a soda. The one thing I learned was even though I wasn't an alcoholic, I didn't realize how alcohol dependent my life had been. Oh, it's a hard day. I'll have a drink. Oh, it was a great day. I'll have a drink. Oh, I'm going to go see a band I really love. I'll have a drink. Oh, I'm at the beach and my toes are in the sand. I'll have a rum runner.
Gotcha.
You know, oh yeah, this is a great dinner. I'm having a glass of wine. I realized that, wow, no, I can still see a great band and not have a drink. I can be at the beach and enjoy the sunshine and not have a rum runner. And how much society and has really reinforced that. I still tip some back, you know, every now and then. I don't drink during my performance, maybe at the end of the night, and usually only on the last day of the run. So if I have to sing the next day, I won't have a drink. And I just feel like I've done things to discipline myself. I practice more. I make sure to keep myself in good shape, and all these things has been a deliberate and conscious effort. And it's almost like an experiment. I want to be the best that I can, and I want to see where that leads. And as an artist, and it's really crazy to be 48 years old and feel like I've made the best album of my career, feel like I'm the most relevant as an artist. And it shouldn't be that crazy because Jeff Beck is 74 and he's still kicking everybody's butt. But, yeah. But you know, I look at a lot of my peers who vanished at my age. And, you know, I get people, some people going, oh, man, it's great that you're still doing it, man. You know, and I'm like, still doing it. I'm just started doing it, dude.
Good for
you.
I
just started. Yeah. So there's really that's a great feeling.
Good for you, man. That's excellent. And anything, you know, I could do and we could do on this show to support that moving forward, man, I'd be really happy to do that. And I'm happy that's how you're feeling and that's what you're experiencing. That's really cool.
Thank you. Thank you.
Hey, you want to talk about Music is the Medicine Foundation?
Yes. In 2010, I started Music is the Medicine with three other friends of mine. And the idea was, they originally said, hey, man, we want to help you out and we want to put the names of your songs on t-shirts, like Love's Got the Power or something like that, and just sell them to people who don't know you, and whatever profits will donate to you, you know, to help your career. And I said, well, why don't we do something better than that and like donate it to somebody who needs something? And that silly idea grew into Music as a Medicine, which is about musical therapy and impacting realistic change in people's lives through music. And some people don't believe that music can be therapeutic. Well, I fully disagree with that because I've seen it firsthand. So we've done things to help kids with autism, nonverbal autism. We did a thing where we started to raise money for guitars for war vets with post-traumatic stress disorder.
Those are both really cool things, man.
Yeah, you know, and here's a great story. This one guy hadn't spoken a word since the Gulf War. And he started to take guitar lessons. And somewhere in the middle of like lesson five, it was a group lesson. He went to the guy next to him and said, can you show me how you did that?
Wow. Oh,
yes. So for whatever reason, guitar was a bridge for communication. A comfort or whatever. And it got this guy to speak who hadn't spoken in years. So we started modest and a good one of the four of us, his name is Mark Cortese. So sort of him and I have continued this on. And another friend of mine in Montreal named Tony Teddy has been very active. And I, you know, getting personal, I really haven't spoken about a lot of these things until very, very recently. And I'd like to keep certain things in my life private, but I feel like it's important to talk about them. And music was very good to me and for me. And the guitar, I don't know, it might have even saved my life. When I was 12, my mom suffers from paranoia and schizophrenia. Mm. And it doesn't manifest itself until later in life.
Right.
When I was 12, my dad had a real estate company. And he had a few employees that worked with him. And one guy was a religious fundamentalist, a Sikh fundamentalist. And he had a major disagreement with my dad. He wanted to get an advance on a lot of money. And became a fight, very passionate, because my dad wasn't willing to do that, a disagreement. Well, the next day, that man went into a courtroom and shot a bunch of people and killed a lawyer in a courtroom.
Holy
court of law.
Shit.
And this is 1982 in Canada. I mean, Toronto has like 30 gun murders a year. I mean, we don't have that kind of gun violence, even though it's escalating now. But
wow.
And to go into a courtroom.
Man, dad's lucky he didn't. You're all like, yeah.
Yeah. So not only that, but he was at large for nearly 15, 20 years. He was literally Canada's most wanted man for decades.
Holy crap.
And there was a big fear that our family's life was in danger. So we had full police protection, and our bus driver was an undercover cop. So somebody going through paranoia and schizophrenia.
Wow. That's gotta be.
That everyday life is tough enough. Any normal person going through that would lose it, being a mother.
Yeah.
So my mom became very, very ill for several years, and now her illness is manageable. But I mean, she was just really in bad shape, man. And the guitar is what got me through. And I thought, after I had a little bit of success, I wanted to give somebody that guitar that I had. You know, I wanted to give somebody that gift that music had given me to heal. And a friend of mine named Tony Teddy in Montreal said, "Anthony, you're never going to believe this." This was about 3 years ago. There's a choir in Montreal General, which coincidentally my mom had been treated there, that's made up of paranoid and schizophrenic patients. They've put out a couple of CDs, and they do gigs, and they've even done some in Europe. I said, "Oh my God, we got to do something for these people." So we found out that they used to rent their PA equipment. So we raised enough money to get them PA gear. And
it's really nice. So,
oh man, it was so cool. So they wouldn't have to rent it. They could rehearse whenever they want. They didn't have to pay to rent it. So we got them to come to a gig, and we learned one of their songs, and they learned one of ours.
Oh,
and
that is so nice. Sang.
Man, dude, there wasn't a dry eye in the room. If you weren't moved by this, you were dead, right? So I told my friend Tony, I said, "We got to do more." And there's a musical therapist there named Danny, who is so amazing, and he's done so many fundamental things that are just incredible. So we talked to Danny, and he said, "Well, Danny, what's your dream?" He said, "My dream is to have a recording studio in the hospital." We said, "We're going to do it." So we begged our fans, knocked on doors, kissed babies, and we raised enough money to get them a recording studio in the hospital so they can make their albums in the hospital. Wow. This program has been so successful, the province is considering testing it in other hospitals.
That's fantastic, man.
Oh, man. And
that's got to make you feel great. Like that this thing you initiated has turned into something so special.
Well, you know, in a lot of ways, my mom felt very sad about being sick or remorseful. You know, she said, "Anthony, I wonder what you might have done had I not been sick, because, you know, you became a musician to heal, you know." And I said, "Mom, my guitar has taken me all around the world. You know, I feel so bad that you've been sick, and nobody likes to see somebody they love suffer, you know. But that's the one beautiful thing that came out of all of this."
That's nice,
man. So what was really moving to me is that they named the studio in honor of my mother.
Wow.
Yeah, man. So one of their doctors said to me, "Anthony, I can tell you most of these people would not be in this alive today if it wasn't for this choir. It gives them self-esteem. It gives them a reason to live. And it's some of the community. It's such a big, big thing." And it reminded me, man, you know, so I got a record coming out tomorrow, and I'm all worried about how my sales are going to be. And I'm calling up my buddies, making sure they're buying the album, and what are the reviews like, and da 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 da. And, you know, music is the medicine really just reminded me that music is about communication. It's so much bigger than all of this stuff. And we've done some pretty cool things, but whatever we've given, it's given back a lot more. So it's been a pretty amazing thing.
Well, dude, thank you so much for sharing that story. That's real nice. Is your mom doing okay?
Yeah, man. With mental illness in her case, it's just got to be managed. And, you know, it's sort of like you might manage, if you're diabetic, your insulin or whatever, you know,
totally
you
got
to manage your meds. And you know, she's got good days and bad days, but the good days outnumber the bad days.
It's great.
And yeah. So it's good. It's really good.
Man, where can people find out information and or make donations to Music is the Medicine?
They have a website. It's musicisthemedicine.org, O-R-G.
Great.
And and the great thing is 100% of what people donate goes directly to what we do. We've remained smaller So we don't have to take administration fees, or we do other kind of fundraisers for administrative stuff. So we're pretty proud to say that every dollar we raise actually goes to, you know, the recording studios or the guitars or what have you.
That's wonderful. And that's a very rare thing. Anybody who hasn't looked into that, when you're dealing with charities, there's an actual website out there that evaluates charities based on this, what percentage of your dollar actually goes to the cause. That's fantastic, man. Everybody, yeah, please check that out. It's musicisthemedicine.org. Man, I can't thank you enough. Let me tell people where to find you. And all my listeners, please support Anthony and check out his new record. First of all, go to his website. It's anthonygomes.com, not Anthony Gomez. It's Anthony Gomes. It's G-O-M-E-S, anthonygomes.com. The name of the new record is Peace, Love, and Loud Guitars, as it should be. And check it out. All his information is on there. And you can also hit him up or see him on Facebook at Anthony Gomes Music. And check him out. I know you're touring. Man, dude, I think you're coming down here, as a matter of fact. That's because I looked at your schedule.
Yeah, in December, we'll be in Florida.
Very cool. And is that an East Coast tour or like a whole U.S. tour? Or?
Oh, yeah, East Coast. And then we're in the West Coast in February. And yeah, East Coast all through November. And yeah, the album's dropping tomorrow, and so is our tour. We got bills to pay, man.
Well, dude, I really appreciate you taking so much time to come on the show in light of all the shit you got going on. Thank you so much.
Oh, man.
I really
appreciate it. Thank you for your time.
Man, my pleasure. Everybody, check out Anthony on tour and check out and buy his new record and support what he's doing. He's a great blues player and he's a really good guy, as you heard. And if you see him on tour and you heard the interview, go tell him that you enjoyed it. Thanks, dude. I appreciate everything. Everybody, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this, please share it with a friend on your social media channels. We appreciate your support. Thanks again to Anthony Gomes for spending time with us. I really appreciate it. Again, support him and come check him out on tour. It's Anthony Gomes, G-O-M-E-S.com. And make sure you go to the homepage of everyonelovesguitar.com. Sign up to get on our newsletter list. And most important, remember that happiness is a choice, so choose wisely. Be nice, go play your guitar, and have fun. Till next time, peace and love, everybody. I'm out. I hope you enjoyed this episode of Everyone Loves Guitar. If you did, make sure you go to everyonelovesguitar.com/subscribe and subscribe to the audio podcast and to our very active YouTube community. And if you have any comments, please write me at everyonelovesguitar.com/hello. We'll see you on the next episode. Until then, make sure you choose happiness, relax, and have as much fun as possible.